Hey friends, you're about to hear a great interview I had with Latasha Morrison. I just wanted to jump in here and let you know that the audio may sound a little bit different than usual, and that's because I had the good fortune of having Tasha here in my home in Austin. We were sitting down in my kitchen, so the audio setup is not what it usually is. Anyway, I think it still sounds really good, but I just wanted to let you know that. And yeah, enjoy this interview. The book is available right now. It's called Be the Bridge. You'll hear more about that in the interview. So enjoy. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go. My guest, Latasha Morrison, is a bridge builder, reconciler, and compelling voice in the fight for racial justice. In 2016, she founded Be the Bridge, a nonprofit organization that equips more than 1,000 subgroups across 5 countries to serve as ambassadors of racial reconciliation. Numerous organizations, including Facebook's Community Leadership Program, Forbes, and Ebony, have recognized her as a leading social justice advocate. A native of North Carolina, Tasha earned degrees in human development and business leadership. She resides in Atlanta, Georgia.
Tasha, thanks for being on the show.
It's good to be here, finally.
It's so good to see you. Sadly, you moved from Austin, so you're not an Austinite anymore.
No, I'm not an Austinite. Really, it's my second home.
Okay.
You know, Atlanta's my first home now, but I still love Austin and the people here. But, you know, I had to leave the heat.
Yeah. I get that. You know, I sympathize with that a lot.
But I do miss driving really fast on the highways. Like, I love
it.
70 and 75. No.
No.
Like, the speed limit is 70 and 75. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so here's some things I learned about in the book.
Okay.
That I didn't know about you. You became a Christian in college, right?
Yes.
What were those circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was so funny because I went to church with my grandparents. So it wasn't that I wasn't exposed to church, but, you know, it was more cultural Christians, like if I believe in Jesus type, you know, thing. And I think I was familiar with, but I was really confused about a lot of stuff because I had a friend that was like apostolic. So she was Pentecostal.
Yeah.
And they were one of those Jesus name only folk. And so it was like, you're not a Christian if you're not baptized this way, you know, that stuff. So I was just really confused about a lot of stuff. So it wasn't until, and then it was like a lot of legalistic things that you have to do this, this, and this before you become a Christian. And I just was like, okay, I'm not going to do this, this, and this. I'll get saved when I'm like 40 or 50. That's what I said when I was like, I'll become
after
a Christian.
You had your fun,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was just like, that's not interesting to me. And it wasn't until I was in college too, I met some other college students that had a totally different perspective. And then it was bigger than something, joining something that's bigger than yourself, understanding, theology more and just different things like that. So I got connected with actually it was a Christian fellowship that they targeted African-American students that were on predominantly white campuses.
And, oh, interesting.
Yeah, I was just at CREW and I was telling them this story where, because the church is segregated, the institutions that we produce, whether it's in publishing or whether it's parachurch organizations, they also become segregated, just like the church. And so, you know, on our campus, I think we had an InterVarsity during that time. And I'm not going to date myself, but it was before they start doing a lot of the initiatives that a lot of the campus ministries have now.
To be more diverse.
Yes, I think that's more of an initiative now. But in the 90s, that wasn't as much of an initiative. And so the students would reach to the people like them. And so,
sure.
And so that's why. And so, but the same thing applied to the campus ministry I was a part of, where they targeted African Americans. And so I can remember growing up in a diverse environment, because I grew up in a military town, but I cannot tell you one white person I met in college, unless it was like a white person that hung with black people.
Yeah.
You know, although we lived together, went to class, there was no social gatherings, no, you know, connection. You know, it was just totally segregated. I did everything that pertained to African-American students on my college campus, and nothing that was integrated. And so, and I just kind of reflected on that as I was writing the book, and like, wow, you know, that's interesting, because when you think about the diverse environment I grew up in, it lended to some of my, probably some of my barriers and walls that I built up, you know, from that standpoint, you know, being in a predominantly white, you know, large campus. So it wasn't like I was at a small school. I was at a large school in North Carolina. So there were plenty of opportunities. But, and you didn't realize that you were doing that. You were just kind of like, that's their style, this is our style, you know. But there was no initiatives to connect, you know, to connect people, you know. So that's one of the things. If I could do that part all over again, you know, I would do it much differently, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it was just a setup, you know, for me to reflect back and see the need for proximity and diversity in your life. And when you think about that, when you think about that whole, I'm going to reach who I am, who's like me. Like, that's, to me, that's just the opposite of kingdom, you
right,
know?
Right.
That's the opposite of what we should be doing. That's the opposite of what we have been instructed to do. Just think about if the disciples did that, you know?
Right, right.
Or if Jesus did that, you know, where would we be now, you know? So, anyway, that's just, I wanted to talk about that because hopefully that as people read that, they will reflect on their own upbringing and maybe their own situations now.
When you started to be in the white church, was it jarring for you? I know some people, they have experiences where there's a kind of naivete thinking that, yeah, I know that white people out in culture like this, but white Christians are going to be different.
It was a whole nother ballgame.
Did you have that naivete, or did you go into it kind of knowing?
I knew going into it, it was going to be a culture shift for me, but I was determined not to change, not to shift myself. I knew a lot of the environments that were about assimilation, but I wanted to bring my full self into those environments. And I would say my first experience was a little different because it was one of those things. It's kind of like that getting to know you proximity where you don't really talk about deep things, but you just talk about like maybe more cultural things, you know, style things, but you're not getting into the issues. And so that first experience, it was kind of like, you know, we ask each other questions, you know, we're comfortable with asking each other questions. As long, and my thing was like, okay, you can ask me a question, but that, first of all, I don't speak for everyone, and then I'm going to ask you questions. You know, why you wear flip flops all the time? You know, when it's 50 degrees outside, why you got on flip flops? You know,
you know, flops and cargo shorts and it's snowing.
Exactly. You know, and why wasn't there that same? I didn't see that same approach that I saw in the African American church of reaching the community and reaching all people and doing the things to be more multicultural in the African American church. I saw more of an initiative in the African American church than I saw in the white church. It was kind of like, we are who we are and the things. And when you think about just the marginalization and who should be doing that, because who, you know, you only have the African American church and the Asian church and these churches because we weren't permitted to worship together in evangelical spaces and in churches, you know, unless you were going to sit in the balcony or you weren't good enough to sit on the pew with me. And even in death, you know, you weren't even good enough. You couldn't even be buried in the same grave, you know, as a white person, you know. Yeah. So when you think about that impact, when we talk about the multicultural movement, that really should be led by, you know, a lot of the white church in that sense, you know. But I didn't see any kind of initiative. It was kind of like, we do want to reach people in our community, but we don't want to change.
Yeah, so I think kind of what you're pointing to is I find that a lot of the most white Christians' attitudes about having a more diverse church is our doors are open to everyone.
Yeah.
Right. Like we're not, we would never turn away anyone. Our doors are open to everyone. Right, and if they don't want to come, that's on them. Right.
That's in language, but it's not indeed in the sense where the church in itself sends a different message, because when you come in there, you don't see yourself, or you don't feel inclusive, or there's not inclusive language, or you feel like the way your style of worship or your style of teaching is subpar, like it's beneath, you know, then you feel a rejection in a sense. And then there's this thing where either I have to fit in, I have to sing like this, I have to learn to play the guitar, I got to throw away my Hammond B, you know what I'm saying? Like the style, you know, I got to clap on one or two. I'm just joking. I'm just kidding. You know,
kind of.
You know, one or three, you know. But it's, you know, but I think some of that is, I think we have to do it together. I don't think a church knows how to do that on its own. You know, I think that takes a lot of skill. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of unlearning. It takes a lot of deconstructing into why we are the way we are, you know. And those are just hard questions that I think any church leadership has that, you know, ask itself, you know. And then what are you willing to do? You know, it's like a lot of the churches, the doors are open, you know.
Yeah.
But the message that you're sending is different, you know, and to connect that, those two things, you know?
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is that for a lot of white churches, although the doors are technically open, all the messages that are being sent in there are not ones that are telegraphing that is a place for people of color.
Right. And you know, one of the things I heard, like read, and as it relates to a multicultural church, that you have to realize when you step into a space like that, that you're not going to be happy probably about 30% of the time. Like it's only going to be 70% of the time. So. Yeah. And so you have to be willing to compromise. It has to be some discomfort. But if you're in a position where you don't want discomfort, you know, we're used to, like, as you'll see more African Americans that integrate into white space because we're used to the discomfort. And in order for us to thrive and survive, we have to know how to code switch. We have to know how, in a lot of ways, sadly, in a lot of places, we have to know how to assimilate. We have to know how to stuff. We have to know how to be traumatized and still function, you know, in environments, or to say, well, you know what, I'm still, like, although this isn't my worship style, I can still feel Jesus in it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
we're more
right.
open.
Yeah, so
you know?
So it sounds like what you're saying is a lot of people of color, they live in this space where
discomfort a lot of times.
Discomfort. Yeah. So they go to a workplace where they constantly have to feel microaggressions or just a place that's not
neighborhood,
meant for them.
Schools,
and so when it comes from church, for church, you find it's much more common to find a few people of color inside a predominantly white church than a few white folks in a black church.
Exactly.
Because the people of color are very used to that kind of whatever, acquiescing, you know, not having it their way.
Right. And you're not going to see that. When I see that, I'm like, okay, wow. What is happening? Sometimes it's a culture thing where how someone grew up and that's what they're used to. Sometimes people are very, I know people now that are being very strategic to be led by a person of color in leadership. Like if you've never had that experience of being led by a person of color, or, you know, having a boss, having a teacher, there's so many people, especially moving to Texas, that I saw, they have never had that experience. They never met another person of color, especially African American, outside of maybe helping someone, like when it's in more of a missional type work, or they never have been exposed to educated, you know, people who are on the same level as you as it relates to yourself, you know, in that context. And so I think that was something, you know, moving to Texas, that was a little different from Atlanta. When I left Atlanta, just being exposed to that. So I think, you know, with the church thing, it was one of those things where for me, it's like you're enjoying this. You love bits and pieces of it. You know, I love the friends that I met in the churches that I've been a part of. But I remember when Trayvon Martin. That's like a turning point, I think, for a lot of people of color, for me, that was a wake up for me as it relates to when we start talking about racial justice, you know, getting serious about that, you know, because having conversations, I remember all this stuff is going on in my community, and because I was still connected socially to my friends in Atlanta, although I was at a predominantly white church, I'm having this conversation. I remember bringing it up to a couple people in the small group that I was in, and it was like the world, it's like this situation didn't even exist.
Yeah.
And that to me was like, what in the world is wrong? Yeah. Like,
right.
You know, and so that was a wake up for me to say, you know what, if I'm going to be in this environment, then I'm going to have to be able to bring my full self and talk about those things that pain me, you know, expecting people to understand. But then when you start seeing the narrative, that's when I started seeing the narrative that are that the church is no different than the world.
Yeah.
You know,
so I think part of what you're saying is that, like, the Trayvon Martin situation, like, that in and of itself was bad enough. But it's something that happens, and you think that you can go to your white friends and all agree about the terrible injustice.
Yeah.
But then often you find out that it's not as clear to them.
Yeah. Yeah. You could tell that they had ingested exactly the narratives that had been created. This was a, you know, 16-year-old boy. This was a grown man. You know, he had the right to be and to do. If there was any questions, you know, you know, just the whole situation in itself. Right. But when you're having this conversation, there were excuses made for the other person. And then you start seeing this time and time again with instances. And in the midst of the Trayvon Martin case is when I moved to Austin. And, you know, it was one of those things, if I, you know, I told the Lord, if you're bringing me back on a church and on the church staff, then I'm, if I'm going to be on the church staff, I'm going to have to speak my mind. I cannot be in an environment where I assimilate. I cannot be in an environment where I go along with the status quo. I cannot be in an environment where I can't challenge authority or you know, or try to help change, you know. And you know, so if I'm going to be in this situation, I want to be in a place where I'm going to be utilized, where I'm going to be used, where, you know, where I could be of some help, you know. And so that was the first church that I was in Austin, where kind of woke me up to a lot of things, you know, a lot of gender issues, just a whole bunch of stuff that I learned from that environment. You know, well-intentioned people, you know, but intent and impact is some big things. And, you know, and you're seeing things there where, you know, you know, you're like, oh wow, there's a Latin congregation that's a part of the church, and they're actually on staff, you know, and you see these things, and you're like, oh, that's great. But then you start seeing, like, where sometimes the voice is left out, you know, you know, where there's no representation of that church on the, you know, as an elder, on the board, or and when heavy decisions are being made, and they're just as qualified. You know, you start seeing these little things, and you're like, okay, why? Okay, that's, there's some bias there. There's a reason. Like, you got to get to it. It's not just because of this. We got to get underneath that. And those are the type of things that I think we have to start challenging ourselves, because sometimes, like, you know, that supremacy will come out in those little things, and you'll think that you have no racial biases, and then the thing is, you don't determine that, you know, as a person of color, you know, you know, in that sense. And, you know, the same for myself, like, if you have a brain, you have a bias. I had to deal with biases I had coming into this environment, that the bias of mistrust, you know, that the style of worship wasn't really, because it wasn't emotional, that it's not real. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So there was a lot of biases that I had to deal with personally. And then on the other side of that, it's like, God could be in the midst of this, but also in the midst of this, you know. It's just different styles, you know. It's different practices and methods, you know. But we had the same goal, you know.
Yeah. You came and preached at the church I'm a part of a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And you told a story, and it's one that you tell in the book as well, about a conversation you had with some people, it sounds like they're probably Christians. There's this family, and they, you've just met them, they're already striking up conversation about, like,
oh, yeah,
civil rights and segregation and yeah, slavery.
Yes!
I'm sure that's their first conversation with everyone.
That stuff happens to me all the time. In Starbucks. Like, people tell me their business on the plane. I mean, like, I'm like, do I have that face that just, like, people just tell me their stuff, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah. And it's not like they know that you're a part of this organization yeah, to help people talk about this stuff. Yeah. They're just like, this is apparently
yeah,
the first Black person I've had the opportunity yeah, to talk yeah, to in a very
so
long
gonna,
time.
Like, I'm going to like
unload
all. Like, I felt like I was on a speed date or something. Like, you know, I'm going to unload everything that I ever thought, you know?
Well, and part of what it sounds like they were doing was they were trying to figure out, quote, what type of Black person
exactly,
you are.
Exactly.
They're vetting
I
you.
I knew exactly what they were trying to do. Okay, am I going to be a safe person? They can
someone who's
going to
just kind of go along.
Yes, go along with the stuff, like, you know, tap dance around situations,
yeah,
you know, smile and nod. You know, I can tell because they were just even asking, you know, like political stuff, you know, and just, they were beating around the bush, you know, and I just remember saying, I'm not going to ask that question, you know, I'm not going to yeah, answer that question. And when we got into that subject of, you know, talking about desegregation, I was explaining how desegregation was really done wrong. It was done with whiteness at the center, like the system of white supremacy at the center of the decisions that were being made, because majority of the schools that were closed were African American schools. When you think about, you know, the teachers that were fired, you yeah, know, were predominantly African American teachers. You know, when you start thinking about that, a lot of the kids were bused into unsafe environments where they were not wanted. And so that's when you start seeing even the dropout rate increase. People, you know, the people that were good in sports and, you know, weren't allowed to play. You know, so you see this in this thing of, you know, those that are inferior had to submit to the superior in those environments, and where those schools at that point had been safe places for African-American kids. Though people understood their culture, their community, and all these different things. So the way we went about it was wrong, because even the Brown versus the Board of Education wasn't necessarily about, it was about equity and equality. Mm-hmm. It was like, we want our schools to have the same things that the other schools have. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily about, you know, our schools are inferior. Our schools were inferior because of the tools that it was given. It's strategic.
Right. Yeah.
That we're going to give you the old books. We're not going to invest in that. And those are the same things that happen now, because you know what? Schools are supported off of property taxes. And then you yeah, have property taxes that are still drawn on the lines of redlining. So you have communities that were redlined and that were
yeah,
never gone back and revalued. You know what I'm
yeah,
saying? So we have perpetuated that issue. That's why when we look at our system now, like, how are schools even more segregated today than they were then? Because we designed it that way, you
right,
know?
Right.
And if you don't like tear the plans up and do a whole nother design, you're going to get the same results every time. And so, but we're, you know, we're a developed country. We're so smart, you know, but we haven't, you know, went back and, you know, fixed those things. So I think, you know, for us having that conversation, I was just talking about that and how the harm that was done, you know, in the African American community, and then kids who had never gone to school with Black kids, you know, they weren't taught anything, a different narrative, you know, to kind of like help with those racial biases and stuff like
yeah,
that. Fear was driving a lot of stuff, and then, you know, and then she started talking about the South, and she started talking about Lincoln, and you know, and I'm thinking like, okay, Lincoln, your dude, right? You like him,
right,
he's the
right,
hero, right?
Right? Yeah, everybody likes
you know,
Lincoln.
Yeah, yeah, everybody likes Lincoln. And she was like, and what he did to the South, you know? And I remember, oh Lord, where are we going? Get me out of this. How do I get out of this? I just want to watch the game, you know?
Right.
And at the thing, and then she said, you know, because people love their slaves.
Yeah, they were like family.
Exactly. And I was just like that slow blink, like,
yeah,
did I just hear that? And
yeah,
you're looking at, first of all, I was hurt, I was wounded.
Absolutely.
That this came from a Christian. Then I started really thinking about how far gone we are.
Right.
In the faith community.
It's depressing.
Disconnected. It's how, like, we have become a part of empire. Like, you know, just that mindset. And I didn't even, and then I'm thinking, like, okay, and then I felt bad because, like, why did she feel like she could say that to me?
That's right. So there's a problem with, like, that being in your mind, but thinking it's okay to say it out loud.
Yeah.
And that's not
a
problem.
Yeah, yeah. And not really thinking until, like, but that's the mindset of a lot of people, that romanticized view of slavery. I see it every day online. I see it when I talk to people, where because we don't teach history, we don't teach proper history. Yeah. Yeah. We misinterpret history here. We make people who, nobody's all bad, but also no one's all good. We don't talk about the things that Lincoln, like, although Lincoln did sign the Emancipation Proclamation, he was not about equity. He was still a racist.
Sure, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, but the thing is, you know, he did not want to share power with people of color. He still thought people of color were inferior. And you can see this in his writings, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, but we need to tell both sides. You need to, because that gives context for what we're dealing with now.
Yeah.
You know, history helps us understand, we don't have to stay there, but it helps us understand the present and why I think the decisions that were made during Reconstruction and all these things have led to some of the injustices that we have now. They're all connected. They're not separate from each other. And so when she said that, it just jarred me at her. I really wanted to cry, to be honest.
Yeah.
And but I was not going to go down like that, you know. And I'm thinking, like, how do I address this? I just started this job, like, no more than 3-4 months. And I want to just set it off right now. I wanted to flip the chairs, the tables, and just make a grand exit, you know. But having to sit there and take that and, like, okay, this has to be a teachable moment. I have to make sure she never says this again.
Yeah.
And definitely never says it to a person of color, you know, whose family was impacted by slavery.
Right.
You know, where you had no choice, no free will, you know. And if your family was in the same situation where they had been oppressed and, you know, someone's boot on their neck and beat because they wouldn't be submissive, you know, or rape, you know what I'm saying? All those different things with the institution of slavery, how would you react? And so I just said, you know, people didn't have free will. You know, that's not love.
Right.
You know? I mean, the gospel, like, Jesus gives us free will. We're born with free will, and that was stripped, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They had no choice.
Yeah.
So this whole
love doesn't control.
Exactly. And so when we try to romanticize, oh, this president had an affair with this person, it was like, no, they didn't have a choice.
Right.
You know, so we got to look at that differently, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to change these narratives in this. And so I just remember thinking, like, Lord, if I'm going to be in this environment, I'm gonna have to tell truth. Like, I'm gonna have to speak the truth. I'm gonna have to get some history lessons. I'm gonna have to correct this stuff because this is a mess. And that was really I would say that was probably the catalytic conversation that God used for me to step out and do something, because then I started seeing just the mindsets, and that started some of the first conversations I had.
So what I love about that story is you in that moment had some choices. And my friend Dan White Jr., he just wrote a book about this, and he's got beautiful language for it that I can't remember. But basically, you had some choices. You could have lashed out.
Yeah.
You know, you could have dehumanized her.
Yeah.
It may have been justified.
Exactly.
And then, but also you could have just ignored it.
Yeah.
You know, you could have just disengaged.
Exactly, or laughed about it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You could have smiled and nodded and then just walked away or whatever. And most people, most of the time, we only have the imagination for those two things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For either just brushing it off our shoulder or lashing out and dehumanizing someone. But you have found this third option, which was engaging and making it this teachable moment.
Yeah.
And you kept the love part, so you didn't exchange the dehumanization that she was giving. You didn't give that back to her, but you also didn't let it go, and you engaged in love. And I think that's what I really like about that story. When you told it at our church, and it stuck with me, because when you told it, my blood was boiling at the moment, and I just thought, I would never in that situation know what to say. Like, it's so, saying something like that is just so far off base. Like, I wouldn't even know where to start. You know what I mean? Like, you feel like you need to go to like a racism 101 class, because I don't even know where to start with you.
But it cost me, that response cost me, because it was very costly, because, I mean, I left out of there like trembling, you know, I was wounded. And I had to talk it through with someone, like, what is this mindset? How could someone say this? You know, this person is a Christian. And I really start seeing how closely connected, you know, that was that Christianity is to this mindset. You know, like, it wasn't just that we were complicit. We created the infrastructure. People did a lot of these things and said a lot of these things in the name of some Christ. I don't know which Christ.
Yeah,
but some Christ, you know. And so that was the thing, really having to process that. So it took me about 3 days to process, you know, that conversation. And then process, okay, how am I going to respond? But you see, I am who I am. I'm naturally like a person that builds bridges. Like, that's just who, if you can ask anyone in my family, just from the time I was a child to now, like, my personality, like, I've always tried to kind of, I always spoke my mind. I'm always a truth teller in that sense. But I've always tried to get to the undercurrent, or try to, you know, like, my family will tell you, you know, I didn't like to talk about, you know, another family member. You know, I would feel uncomfortable when that would happen, you know, just stuff like that, you know. It's in my DNA, you know. And so I couldn't let that sit, as far as, like, I cannot.
Not say anything.
Yeah, and because I think about my community. I don't want my community to be hurt by people like that, or to have to give defense for stuff like that.
Right.
So although, you know, my work is for the kingdom, I connect it back to, you know, I want my community to be understood. You know, I want all marginalized communities to be understood, and for their stories to be known and told, and their history not to be erased.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then I want... And I know a part of that creates the oneness that we all desire, you know. And then in the midst of this, you meet people who want to know. They want to engage, you know. They want to change.
They're hungry for it.
Yeah. So, you know, so on the other side of that, you know, that was the situation. But that person became someone that I talked to a lot, you know. It didn't end there, you know.
Yeah.
But it started there. Right, you know, in a sense, you know. And it was just that conversation was, I think, used to kind of jolt me, like, are you gonna get in this? Are you gonna be a part of it? Or are you just gonna sit here and just grin and smile and tap dance?
Yeah.
You know.
Part of that story is, especially when you talk about the desegregation part and the history, is something that you emphasize a lot in the book, which is just dealing with acknowledging and lamenting over our history.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of what people want is just to say, let's just get along now. Mm-hmm. Like, just from today on, like, let's just get along now. And let's not talk about that stuff that happened in the past. Mm-hmm. Why is it so important that we do that?
I mean, let's think of it in just a relational way. If you were building a relationship with anyone, if I was getting married and there was this traumatic history that happened in my husband's life, like whether it was abuse or anything like that, is that information I would want to know? Or do I just say, well, we're just building a new life now. We're starting from scratch. We're just starting here and that's it. You know, what happened in the past is the past. We can just move forward from here. Do you not think that history of his life has informed how he would, what type of partner he would be, what type of father, what type of friend, what kind of, you know, co-worker. That history has informed all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're really going to be one with someone, you have to understand who they are. We have to understand each other. You, and anything else in life, We don't do that. We don't do that about scripture. Biblical history is very important to our faith now. You know, the thing, our practices, our faith practices, a lot of that comes from history. How we, you know, when we do communion, that's a part of remembrance. You know, we celebrate, you know, Christmas, remembrance. We celebrate Easter, Resurrection Sunday, that's remembrance. I mean, and just even if you think about the Jewish faith, all the things that we do, baptism, all those things are remembrance. And yeah. So memory, we only get amnesia when it comes to racial stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the only time we get it. You know, we understand it about anything else. We don't get it when it comes to Confederate memorials.
That's what I was about to say. That's exactly what I was about to say. Unless we don't want to have a memory until it comes to Confederate memorials, and then we can't whitewash history.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, this is about heritage. You
exactly.
know what I'm saying? Okay,
exactly.
You know, so it's just those things where we get amnesia about the things that make us uncomfortable,
yeah.
and that we want to get amnesia. We have to yeah. be honest about that, you know? And then on top of that, we'll rather take a lie over truth.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
we'll rather take a lie and say, like, okay, do you know, like, most of these things were erected, these monuments that we built to people, they were erected, like,
in the Civil Rights era,
yeah. as a direct,
response.
You know, response
yeah,
yeah. to that,
Civil
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when we start talking about those initiatives, but it's so important to us. And so if that history is just as important, the history of our brokenness, or the history that shaped America, the history that shaped and traumatized a community, and not just my community. This is, we're talking about the binary of black and white right now, but what if we talk about Native history?
Right.
You know, the Japanese history, the Chinese history in here, where, you know, Chinese men were in could come, but their families couldn't come. They couldn't get married, or, you know, they only could have certain jobs. You know what I'm saying? There's
yeah.
a lot of that history where it doesn't mean that it has to make us have this shame and guilt, but I feel like there's this collective shame that leads us towards justice. So we speak this truth because we don't want to repeat it. The same way that
yeah.
Germany has done
That's right.
with their own history, where
yeah.
they speak that truth. You're not going to go and you're not going to see a Nazi flag anymore that represents the Nazis, but what they do use is the Confederate flag now.
Nazis do.
Yeah.
To get around.
Because they know.
To get around the Nazis.
Yes, because racists know what's racist.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although we say it's not racist, racists know what's racist. They, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you think about any country, like every country, like Canada, even if they haven't rectified or resolved, they have owned their truth.
Mm-hmm.
Australia, they have owned their truth. New Zealand, they're owning their truth.
Yeah.
Germany, now they've owned their truth with their people. They haven't done it with, when we're talking about colonialism and, you know,
sure.
a lot of those countries,
yeah.
you know. But owning the truth is a part of the healing process,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Especially for, like, none of these countries that I just named really claim that they are a Christian organization, you know, country, and that their the founding fathers were Christians, and their documents, the Constitution and the Bible, are entangled, you know, like that's the type of stuff I hear, you know.
Yeah.
And for a country to claim that and not to lead with love and action, that's hypocritical. You know, we could at least start with history, and teaching truth should be easy. And when we talk about Christians, we know that truth is what transforms us, you know.
That's right.
We know what the belt of truth holds it all together, you know. We know that truth makes us free. And so for us to now start denouncing truth,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying, like, we're on a very dangerous, slippery slope, you know, when we start doing stuff like that. So
once that happens, like, once truth is actually acknowledged and talked about and brought forth in the
mm-hmm.
light, like, what does it look like to actually lament that then?
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, lament means to have great sorrow and to mourn together, like, to say that was wrong. And then also, when we talk about a part of that lament should lead us to confession and to repentance. And repentance means turning away from. So anything that we've established and exalted here that will cause harm so that all are not flourishing, then we turn away from that. It means to complete turning away from that.
Yeah.
So any systems, laws, policies, all of that, if we have to give up something,
mm-hmm.
in order for that oneness to happen. That's what we do. And so that leads us to restoration and redemption. This is, I mean, it's our faith walk. It's what we do when we, you know, as a part of our faith walk, when we come into the knowledge of who Jesus is and what he has done. We have to acknowledge the history and the past and the sacrifice, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In order for that reconciliation to happen. And then, therefore, we can be reconciled to God and now to each other. And so it's no different, you know.
Yeah.
And so we act brand new when it comes to, you know. But if anybody knows how to do the work of restoration and reconciliation well, it should be the church.
That's
right. And it has to start with truth. So we can't, you know, separate that. You know, we have to talk about that, even as painful it is, as it is, you know.
Yeah.
And talk about, like, how do we not do this? It's not enough to say, to make a declaration in your doctrine or your doctrine statement and say, you know, we acknowledge that we had, you know, funds and we, you know, we were divided by slavery, you know, our denomination. But then you don't do any restorative process to start shifting those policies. You don't change the power dynamics. You don't, you know, it's just empty words.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like if we don't do that gutting out as it relates to our faith, you know, it's just words. It's just semantics. Like, it doesn't mean anything. It's empty. You know, when there's no action of redemption following that, you know, and what that looks like. And I don't feel like, we set the course for that. I think that has to be established by unbiased people, you know, in order for the real work to be done. That's tough. That's tough. That's a hard place to be in. It could be done, but it's a stripping away. I think about Rwanda, where the country had to be basically destroyed in order for it to be built up again. And here you are. This is a country that was 93% Christian, one of the most evangelicalized, like, missionalized, whatever, you know, countries in Africa where this happened. So it just shows you it's in the water.
I just, as you're talking, it's making me just realize how I think one of the things that makes that so hard for Americans to grasp is just our American individualism.
Yeah.
So like this idea that, like, our fathers' sins don't just die with them, you know, because in American individualism, it's just all about me. And like, I didn't do any of those things, you know, I didn't enslave anybody and I wasn't even around during whatever.
Right.
But to go back to what you're saying, Christians more than anyone, or as much as anyone, should be able to understand that, because we come from this, there's this idea within Christianity and Judaism that God speaks to us as a people.
Yeah.
Like, I was studying about, like, the Jewish Passover meal, and one of the things about the Passover meal is that when the kind of liturgy, the script that Jews would repeat when they're taking the Passover meal, is that they would say, you know, remember when we were slaves in Egypt and you saved us. And they're saying this generations after that actually happened. But there's this concept there that they are a part of those people that were there during that time.
The Bible is collective.
It's so collective.
It's so collective. And so that's why, you know, I feel like not just even American, you know, Christianity. I think when we talk about just Western culture, in the sense where this individualistic mindset, individualistic American exceptionalism, that is not from, when we think about systems, that's more empire than kingdom.
Yes.
You know, and so that's something I think we have, I have to leave that behind. You know, like, to do the work that I'm doing, I have to leave that behind. I have to think of I do this just as much for the African-American community, the Native community, the white community. You know what I'm saying? It's like, because if I didn't care, I wouldn't be in here talking. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that part of what I'm hearing you say is that it's not just about liberating people of color from white supremacy or the oppression from white people, but it's also about liberating the white people from being the oppressors.
It's you know, it's just as bad. The oppressed lose and the oppressor loses.
That's right.
You know, and so when you start seeing each other as a collective, that we're connected to one another, that I only belong if we belong, you know, and when we really start taking that to heart, I think that shifts. And so I think sometimes, you know, sometimes we do want to separate ourselves, but the pain of this work can cause you to think individualistically, in the sense where I'm only looking out for mine. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking out for my people. But when I have a kingdom mindset, my people equals all people, so that all may flourish. So that doesn't mean that so that all Native people or all, you know, Puerto Ricans or, you know, like, may flourish. That means that all may flourish. And so that's different. And so when we think about this collective, this collectiveness that we had when, you know, like as you were talking about Judaism, you know, when you think about the sense of Achan, you know, we can go back as far as, I mean, just time after time. And then, you know, when we think about Deuteronomy, you know, write them on your doorpost. Like, there was always this connected. We're connected. So you didn't cause the problem, but we're responsible to fix the problem.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, I as a white guy, I benefit from the problem still.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And it's like saying that, you know what, my house is having problems. I bought this house and it's not my responsibility. Yeah. It's the people who built the house. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know,
that's a great
like
metaphor.
That, you know, that it's like it's the people who built the house. But you know what? You live in the house now.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, how do you hold them responsible when they're no longer a part of the house? And so I think those are just the concepts, you know, that we have to think about. And it's a part of coming out of yourself, you know, and that's hard to do. Because, I mean, you're talking about deconstructing thoughts, and you know, but I think we've ingested this whole empire mentality versus a kingdom mentality, that third space. And it's like, what I want to see would be the bridge is it becomes that third space, that we are more kingdom focused than empire focused, because we live in a world that idolizes empire and empire mentality, and how do we fight against that in our own life, you know, and look at the way of Jesus. And so that's, I mean, that's even some stripping away that I have to continuously do each day, like renewing my mind, becoming more like Christ each day. Like this is a lifestyle that I live. When we talk about Be the Bridge, you know, this is not a checkbox. It's not a trend. It's not a movement. I'm not trying to start a movement. I'm trying to have a transformational lifestyle. And I think when we commit to the words of Jesus in the kingdom of God, this work right here is what we are all called to, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's hard. You know, that's even hard to say even in my community. Because it's kind of like, I didn't break it.
Sure.
And I don't put that burden on me to fix it. And this is the thing, it's not going to be everyone. This work is not, you know, I want everyone to be a part of it. But I do understand that the kingdom of God works in remnants. It's not like what you say. If you can convince 3.5% of the population, that's how change happens.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm looking for the 3.5%. And, you know, like, who are the people? Are we going to sit on the sidelines like some of our parents and say, like, where were you when this was happening? I don't even remember. This won't happen. That was a conscious decision. There's an isolated box. Are we going to bury our head in the sand or just let these things pass us over because it's too hard or it's too uncomfortable to address, or we're afraid that we're going to lose something? You know, and that's where it keeps a lot of people, you know, neutral in this, is because they're afraid that they're gonna lose something. They're gonna lose their following,
sure.
You know. But we have to lay it all on the table every day. You know, I lay it on the table where even with my organization, I have to hold it with open hands. It's not mine. You know, it's not mine. So it could be here today and gone tomorrow, just by people saying I'm not going to support, or, you know, having the wrong revenue streams, or, you know, not diversifying enough, all those different things. But every day I have to look at it like, this is not my work. And so I also look at it like, people are not rejecting me, you know. So,
and I think that that's why the work on Be the Bridge is so special, and also what you yourself are doing, because I know a lot of people of color that the work is just too traumatizing.
Yes, for them. It is.
And saying, you know, just so you're talking about like having like meeting random white people in public who think it's it's like, you know, ask a black woman time.
Yeah, yeah.
People who didn't sign up for that.
Exactly. They don't want to do it. And we're not monolithic. And
that's
so,
right.
And so the thing is, like, I feel like a part of this, I do it so they won't have to, you know?
Yeah.
And so I felt like, you know, I feel truly that for such a time as this, I feel like, you know, I've been, you know, built for this in a sense, you know, not yeah. like, it's not to say I don't have my days, you know, or my moments or my hours or my minutes, you
sure.
know, but it's like, this is hard and it is traumatizing. So you have to make sure that you have self-care. You have to have good people around you. You have to have people that lift up your arms. You have to know when to say, this is a space I want to be in and this is a space I don't want to be in. You know, you have to do that. You have to set up safeguards and then you have to take breaks. There's mm-hmm. people that like, you know what? I can't do this. You know, this is too much for me. And I understand that. Everybody didn't march with King.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. but a lot of people benefited, you know,
right.
and that's okay. It wasn't like, he was like, okay, if you didn't march, then you don't get this right to vote. You can't buy no house over here. Like, you know, it's not about that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it takes some to lead, you know, and others will follow later, you know. Maybe
yeah.
this is not their thing, but maybe their thing is once things are, maybe they're part of the reconciliation process. You know what I'm saying? Everybody
yeah, yeah.
has they may have their space in it, but this part, this chiseling away may not be
yeah,
their part.
And I also think that there are, it's not going to look the same for everyone.
It's not.
So I was telling Amanda, I'm going to a protest this weekend in El Paso, and like,
okay.
Kate's going to stay here with our kids,
mm-hmm.
and she was saying, you know, I feel like I'm like, this is me being part of the protest.
Yeah,
I'm taking care of your kids.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
I said, absolutely,
exactly.
you are.
We all have.
You
our
are a part of that.
Do your part. Like, you know, someone's part may be. Everybody's part is not to have a platform, but maybe someone's part is to make sure their family embraces this and they teach
right.
their children true history and they model this out in their life and with their family. They don't sit around and let their family say crazy stuff.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
maybe that's your part.
Yeah.
You know, maybe someone's part is to say, you know, I'm great at history. I'm going to write, you know, supplement books for parents, or I'm going to, you know,
yep.
you know, do... Everybody's part looks different. Everybody's part is not writing a book or speaking or challenging or protesting and different things. Like, I'm not going to El Paso to protest, but I protest every day.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
and
right.
in the words that I speak, you know. You know, so it's just all those things, you know, I'm thinking of. And you want to do more. And the thing that I struggle with is, like, you cannot be the voice for everything. Like, there's so much this happening in
yeah.
our country and happening so fast that... just trying to keep up, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, things that are happening in Puerto Rico, you know, like there's, and then, and even on the other side of that, just having oneness, even in the marginalized community, even fighting for that, because there's a lot of disunity, even within that, like not knowing each other's stories, not understanding each other's story, not lifting each other's stories up. So you deal with even that, and sometimes the burden is too much to carry.
Yeah,
you know, and it's
right.
like I always say, I'm gonna miss it. You know, I'm gonna be interviewed, and it's not like I'm speaking for all people. People are gonna just think I'm just focusing on African American people. You know, I'm African American. You know, so
yeah, yeah.
so that's the story that I know.
Yeah.
But it's up to every individual to bring their story, and then also for me to consciously think, how do I have inclusive language in what I'm saying?
Sure.
You know.
And I think too, for me, that's where Jesus and Christianity is so paramount, because I can't imagine trying to be a part of the solution without my faith, because I have to believe that God is already at work in the world,
mm-hmm.
And because if not, then I think it's all on me. Right. And I will self-destruct trying to fix it all, because
right.
it's all on us. But if I believe that God's at work in the world mm-hmm. and he's simply inviting me to come along,
right.
then that changes everything.
Right, right. And see, that's a good mindset for you, because there's some accountability, you know. But I know people who are, you know, faith people who are trying to do this work within their church, and they do it as a part of their job and more of the secular space. Mm-hmm. And they found that in the secular space is a little bit easier.
Sure.
And that's sad yeah. because it just shows you what is informing our belief system as Christians, you know, what is informing our values that we've developed. You know, there is like there's some things there that we have to kind of like, you know, really ask, you know, some questions as a way we exegete scripture, or the way we are interpreting scripture and culture in the Bible. Like, you know, what entanglement, you know, have we allowed ourselves to ingest? And that's something.
And it also shows what a poor job we've done in the church of talking about what the gospel really is, and that we're embodied beings. Mm-hmm. It's not just about arranging some kind of mental furniture mm-hmm. to follow Christ. It's, no, we're embodied, so something is required of
right.
us. And
that's good.
And we're, to borrow a phrase, we are, to be a Christian means to have an allegiance to a king. And so mm-hmm. that requires something
yeah.
from me, right?
Yeah.
It's not just about believing
yeah.
the right
yeah.
stuff. I actually have to do something.
But allegiance to what king? You know what I'm saying? I think some
yeah.
people...
Well, yeah, you got to get Jesus right
yeah,
first,
like, you
right?
know, like,
yeah,
it's yeah. like, because these idolizations that we've created, I think that's a part of the problem.
That's right.
It's
so,
not
yeah,
America.
Yeah.
So, like, America, for a lot of people, their king is America.
Yes.
For a lot of kingdom, their king is their partisanship.
Well,
or, you know,
and
or,
not only
or
that,
even our racial identity in that sense, you know?
So, yeah, even if your king is God, though, it doesn't matter if your God is a white guy.
Exactly. It's God, but it's blue-eyed.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So even all that stuff, there's just so much to that we have to unravel that I
yeah.
think it becomes exhausting for people and too hard, you know?
Yeah.
And so I do feel like this work, has to be supported by majority culture, by white people,
yeah.
but it needs to be led by people of color.
Yeah,
it does.
That's so good.
You know, it does.
So we've talked a lot about Be the Bridge, but just for those listening who aren't familiar with it, what does Be the Bridge do?
Yeah,
what are the mechanics of it?
Yeah, Be the Bridge is, you know, a nonprofit organization where we develop tools and resources to help people to have a transformative conversation around racial healing, you know. And so we've created a process. We have tools. We've developed videos. We have college curriculum. We also have youth curriculum that we just got funded through Facebook to do. So we're starting that whole movement. We have webinars where we help white people walk through this. You know, we have people, experts and professionals to help white people kind of walk through this. We're developing resources for people of color specifically to really address some of the disunity within our spaces too. Mm-hmm. So wherever there's a gap, you know, we're that on-ramp, you know, where people can get started, as long as they're in a place of awareness and acknowledgement. If you're coming to us and saying, convince me that it's broken, then guess what? You can convince yourself right out that door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because that's not, and that may be hard for a lot of people, but I am not trying to, if you can't see, then there's some, that's a heart condition. I'm sorry.
Sure.
So that, and
sure.
I can't resolve that. That's, you need to pray.
So to be a part of it, basically, people need to come in with at least a posture of listening.
Of listening,
and
learning, and being able to lament and then leverage.
Yeah.
And so, and when I say leverage, I mean leverage your privilege, you know,
yeah.
in that sense, like you're doing right now, put me on the podcast, you know, that's leveraging a privilege that you have, you
sure.
know, being able to sit with someone in their pain and to lament with them, even when you don't understand, that's empathy,
mm.
you know, like that's
yeah.
a part of developing that empathy muscle, to learn, to educate yourself, don't expect someone to teach you, but to pick up books, read resources, you know,
yeah.
Do the work,
yeah.
you know, don't expect that. We have we have this document called 16 Tips for White People, you know, that kind of helps starting there. And then to listen, because we've been in environments where a lot of times where we've been done all the talking. And so I think in this, you have to have a posture of listening to one another. And this goes to even for people of color who are confused about a lot of this stuff, because we live and drink the same water. We are impacted by the same things. And so you have a lot of people that are even blind. It depends on what environment they've grown up in. And yeah. so sometimes even in that situation, if 95% of the people are saying the stove is hot, then maybe it's hot. And you got 5%, people want to listen to that 5%, but that 5% has no power. That 5% needs to do the same thing, to listen and to learn and to educate yourself. I have to educate myself on stuff every day. All these stories that I tell in the book, historical stories, that was not taught to me in school. That was taught to me. I learned some of this stuff in college, but most of it I didn't even learn in college, you know, unless you take that track, you know.
Sure.
But you have to search it out, you know. And so this is stuff that you learn after the fact. It's documented. Our history is documented, you know. And so this is not hidden from anyone. So, but it's just a matter of us taking the posture of learner to say, I want to really know truth. There's things that happen. You could start with your own community and city. If you wonder why there's less, you know, people of color in your community, find out. I know there was people talking about that in Oregon. Well, do you know that Oregon was a white state, you know, where people of color were not permitted to live there, you know? So there's a reason for that. And so I think we have to search those things out and understand what happened in your county, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lynching memorial, legacy memorial that EJI has constructed up and down in Montgomery. I advise everybody to go see, where we start looking at the history of lynching. And you know, some of this is done by, you know, you have to understand that the KKK was a culture. It's not just, it's an organization, but it was a culture. It was a mindset that a lot of people participated in. So it's good for people to see that history. And I think Brian Stevenson has done a great job at honoring those lives and memorializing them, where they weren't documented on purpose.
Yeah.
But their stories live on through their families. It was a friend of mine that's actually here in Austin that just found out that her her great-grandfather was a lynching victim, you know? And so that's that's just news. But his name isn't in the memorial yet, because it's still stories that need to be told. And so that's the history, you know? Mm-hmm. So when we start elevating, you know, in certain states, we start elevating, making proclamations to KKK founders and members and stuff like that, you know, you're re-traumatizing families that were directly impacted by the terrorism, you know, that has happened, you know, that was done by that that terroristic organization. So, and it's not just an organization, it's a mindset, you know, it's an ideology, you know. So I think those things are important, you know, for us to know and to understand. So I think in Be the Bridge, we start giving language to that and talking about those things and talking about things that are happening now and what our posture should be and how we should kind of read between the lines, you know, hopefully giving people new perspectives and stuff like that. This is a hard time to be in this type of work, a very hard and difficult time. A lot of people of color are like taking time out, you know, because it's just too hard.
Yeah,
we've lost a lot of people of color in this work because of just, you know,
it's taxing.
It's taxing, and they feel let down. You know, people feel let down by what's happening, where I'm having to explain my humanity and like trying to get you to read between the lines. And I was just somewhere and I was like, you know, and I'll just say it quick here, but throughout history, if we look at the remnant of folk that called out and said that that the institution of slavery was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, think about that. It may be during that time, although it was legal, it was not just. And so sometimes the things that are legal are not just, and sometimes the things that are just are not legal.
Yep.
But there were a remnant of people that said that that was wrong. It wasn't everyone. Majority said it was a good thing because it made money. Okay. Yep. But then when we think about people of color, we've always said it was wrong. So when we think about Jim Crow era, people that were fighting against that, people of color, we've always said it was wrong. You know, we talk about civil rights, and then, you know, if you look 20 years from there, you see people say, yeah, it was wrong. this is wrong. How could they do this? How could we have an institution of slavery for centuries? How could we do, you know, Jim Crow for decades? Yeah. The civil rights movement, how in the world can they, you know, attack children with dolls and water hoses and all this stuff? You know, why couldn't they vote? You know, we look back on that and we say, that is so wrong. We hear segregationists today. We hear those speeches and we're like, oh my God, we cringe at it.
Right.
But in all of that, people of color has always said it was wrong. We've always been on the right side of history. And all those things I've named, the church has been a voice for the oppression.
Right, right. The white church.
Exactly, the white church. Listen, thank you for making that correction. The white church, said the white man. You know. And so when we think about now where we are in history, as we're crying out talking about mass incarceration and all the things that we're talking about at the border and all these different things. It's people of color were crying out. And so what will history say about you in 20 years? And what side will you be on in 20 years? Will it be an embarrassment for your family? Or will it be something that can be celebrated?
Yeah.
And that's the way some of us look at now, like, you know, where was my grandfather in, you know, during the civil rights movement? Or where was my family an abolitionist? You know, all these different things. Are you setting the same course? Are you going to create a different narrative?
Right.
And I know there's people in Be the Bridge, they're creating different narratives for their family. They're creating a different legacy. They can't do anything about the things that were done before them and where their families were complicit or, you know, are silent. But they can make a different choice. And so that's what I'm saying, because history keeps receipts and we're going to give an account.
Yeah.
And 20 years from now, we're going to be listening back to this conversation and some of the things that's happening now in our country, and we're going to be like, oh my goodness. And we have to look at, you know, in all of these things that we have, you know, the atrocities across not just this country, but across the world globally, the role that Christians play in empire and not in kingdom.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something for us to be said, you know, that we really have to think about what is informing our faith.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so part of what I hear you saying is that in some of these issues that come up around race, for white folks who just don't know how to feel about it, look to the people of color and see how they feel about it.
Look to the people of
because
color.
Because they've not
just
been
one.
Wrong.
Not just one.
That's right. And not just one. And not the 5% of people of color that, that Fox News loves to give a microphone to.
Exactly. Look to the majority. What is the majority saying? You know, what does the majority say? Everybody wasn't marching, but there were a lot of people at the March on Washington, and that and then that crowd was very diverse. And so there are a remnant of people that are speaking up now. But the thing is, will we have the ears to hear, or what are we blinded by?
Yeah.
You know, and I think I would say, you know, if you're listening to this and you just don't get it, don't understand, I would say pray that your eyes will be open.
Yes.
You know, pray that your eyes will be open and go from there and really, you know, turn the radio off, turn the news off, start reading a book, just read scripture, you know, and see what starts happening with your heart, you know.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think that so many, especially I think white folks, when they start getting into this conversation and having their eyes open, they think, if I just like educate my white friends and family, then they'll know and they can change their mind. And I found out that that is not the case. And that's also how, seeing things through the lens of Jesus helps me make sense of it, because if I know that we are not against flesh and blood,
exactly,
but there are powers and principalities.
Yes, yes.
There are. I'm still
in high places.
Old school enough to believe in demonic forces that want us to believe that things are fair, that things have always been fair, that we're on a level playing field now. I think that there. I think that demonic forces, Satan loves for us to think that.
Yes.
And so that's why we have people that are Christians that seem to love Jesus, and they're also smart. but cannot see this.
Yeah,
cannot see this.
It's like completely blind to it.
That's right.
I mean, what you would say, what we would call good people, but completely blind. And I mean, you think about that as it relates to the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And, you know, just, to, I mean, look at who Jesus, I mean, largest critics. It was the ones that were marginalized and oppressed that really took to the word of God, you know?
Yeah.
And the elite...
couldn't see it.
Yeah. I mean, crucified, you know, him. And so when you think about that, I don't want to be that, you know? And so even every day, like if it's something I'm missing, I'm like, I'm humble enough to say like, Lord, let me see, you know, show me something new. Like if I'm missing it here, help me to understand this. And then in the midst of all of this, make sure as I seek justice that my heart doesn't grow bitter to those that I want to have justice from, in the sense where I'm not praying as much for redemption. And that's the thing, is keeping my heart pure in the midst of all of this, because it's easy to say, you know what, I want to blow it all up.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's important, you know, in the midst of this, that still longing for restoration, even for those that oppress, you know, and that's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard. But I would say, I'm not speaking for all African-American, but when I look at the receipts of history and how in the receipts of history, there's never been retaliation.
Yeah.
You know, there's never been a mass murdering of white people. That's never been the case. But on the other side of that, you've seen that.
Yeah.
Against all people of color.
Yeah.
And so when we think about that, like, people want to be seen as human beings. They want dignity. They want equality. They want equity. They want the right to live and to flourish. You know, it's not about revenge and, you know, all these different things, and about removing power so you can now execute power against someone else. It's, you know, that's it's never been about that.
Right.
You know, it's really been as, you know, leave me alone and let me be in peace. And, you know, I would love oneness if you want it, you know, but I've seen a history and receipts of forgiving people for the unforgivable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And you've seen people living out generational trauma, but still seeking reconciliation.
Yeah.
You know, you know, so I think it's something to learn from the communities of color, and specifically the African-American community, and how resilient and courageous that my community has been. You know, we're not a violent people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, and history gives an account.
That's right.
You know,
right.
And so I think it's just important for us to reflect on that and think about those things and have these conversations, you know, like, you know, Be the Bridge is about proximity, but proximity alone doesn't shift things, you know.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
people that have kids of color that are just as racially biased and just set in their way. So proximity, you know, it's only when you're applying the educating of oneself and taking that and acting it out in empathy and lament, you know, that's when the proximity works. So you can live beside someone, you can have friends, you know, that are close, but if you're not getting underneath that, so proximity alone will not change you.
Yeah.
That's just one part of it, you know, so.
That's so good. So Be the Bridge groups, they're these actual groups that meet in people's homes and churches all over.
Organizations, corporations, you know, the way we design Be the Bridge is for, it's not from the top down. It can come from the bottom up.
It's very grassroots.
Grassroots. We want people to do it with a diverse group of people, but we also have created groups just specifically for white people that's called BTB for white people. We're so creative. It's just called
That's great.
So,
you probably have a really long meeting, you know, to come up with that name.
So there's groups for people to understand white culture, white identity, to really get underneath that hood first and before even engaging in Be the Bridge groups, and we've developed some college conversations. Colleges need to be proactive in this work and not reactive, because things will happen. You're bringing people from across the world, you know, to a college campus that have all types of biases and narratives that where they've been raised. And so if a college campus don't lead out and oneness and lead out and what do we do when, you know, and so what we do is create the tools that colleges and organizations on college campuses can use. The same thing with youth. We're trying to get youth to really start groups within their schools and their churches, their communities. You know, a lot of Be the Bridge parents are now starting some youth groups. So there's a lot of stuff, because if you're going to change the future, you really have to make sure that we're pouring into this generation, or unless the work kind of dies
cycles
out, it cycles out. And so those are the things that we're trying to do. So it's really conversational, in how we do that. And, you know, and we have online, you know, groups and webinars and those things like that. So we're just really getting started. We're only 3 years old. And we've been able to do a little bit more this year because we've had, you know, more resources. And so, you know, we have stuff that people can get licensed for, just all types of things. And then we have the book now. And so we have this book where people can learn and understand the process and how do they get involved and all those different things. And so it starts with awareness and really acknowledging, you know, because you can be aware, but until you acknowledge. And now once you acknowledge, what do we do? And so Be the Bridge is for those people who are thinking like, okay, how can I be a part of the solution? Where do I start? What can I do? And, that's when you're in that heart posture, those are our people, you know. So if you're not at that heart posture, you know, probably need, there's some other groups that do some of that other stuff before then, you know. We're only doing one part of a large part. We're only one voice. We're not the only voice. We're just one way, not the way. You know, so
That's so good. So the book is called Be the Bridge, and the tagline is Pursuing God's Heart for Racial Reconciliation. Uh-huh. When does the book come out? Is it out?
October 15th.
Okay, so we got a while. Okay.
Yeah, October 15th.
October 15th. Get it. Is it pre-order?
Can you pre-order now. We're going to be doing some pre-order campaigns where you'll get some extra things. There's some liturgies that I wrote in there.
Yeah, I love those.
Yeah, and so... you know, so you can get those, and there's some other pieces that we have as people pre-order, and we're going to do those campaigns. But right now it's available. I think you can get it at Barnes & Noble, Christian Books, and Amazon. You can pre-order
from there.
So yeah.
And if somebody wants to be a part of a Be the Bridge group, would they go to your website?
Yeah, well, one of the things is the way our groups work is that you have to start a group or partner with someone else to start a group. And so right now they can find out information on our website. They can download the material, and then you register your group. Let's say, go back and rewind. You register your group by downloading the guide, and then you can start your group. But I would tell people, if you're a white person, I would say start with the BTB for white people first.
Okay, cool.
And then think about the next group. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Cool. It's, and the groups are like all over the country, and some outside.
New Zealand.
That's so cool.
Canada. Like, just, it's just one of those things, that God is like, I think there's a process that we've created, and people can insert their own context, but it gives people something to start with that's simple, that's not so complex. And so we're always thinking of ways on how we can make it better, you know, and that's why we keep it in the PDF format, so we can shift it and change it and add resources and stuff like that. So we have a great team that does a lot of those things. And so they can, you know, you could, in our, we have an online Facebook group that's private and secret, that you have to answer questions to get in, and you have to actually be quiet for 3 months before you can engage.
Yeah.
But even there, you can still look and read, and you can see, if you look up your state, you can see where people are trying to start groups and get connected there.
Yeah.
We have a leader group, so those who are starting groups or started groups, there's a leader group, and we're going to have orientations and trainings in there to help really train leaders to do this work. Because you don't just do a group and like, oh, I did a group, yay. You you want to reproduce your group. You want to grow more groups out of your group. We want churches to start groups, communities, you know, all that stuff. So that's, you know, it's just kind of like that one person at a time, one group at a time. And so everybody in your group may not get it at the end. But maybe there's a few people that really do get it. But I've just heard so many great stories from groups and some challenges, a lot of challenges. And but you have to work through them. And so we're trying to create the tools to help people work through them. So
yeah, that's so cool. I was a couple of weeks ago, I was preaching at a small church in one of the suburbs. And I was just talking about different things that we could look to see how God is at work in the world. And I mentioned Be the Bridge, and I said, anybody here in a group? And there were several people in the room that were in the group. So
I'm amazed. I just need all these groups to register themselves.
You make sure you register.
Give us the data so that we can continue the work.
Yeah.
And get the funds, because this is the type of work people don't necessarily financially support, this like type of work.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not a well, it's not like tangible. But we want to keep creating videos and stuff like that. And we're redoing our website. So you'll see a lot of new stuff that we'll have up there and, you know, stuff like that. So we're going to keep doing, filling the gaps as much as we can. And we have now we have a team of people where before it was just me. And I was supporting myself through speaking and stuff like that. But through our grant, I was able to do this full time and then bring on two other people to help do it full time. So that's been a blessing.
You bring up a good point, because there's this beautiful culture in churches that is, you know, monthly giving to organizations like Compassion International and things like that. And we do those things. I love those things. But I think this work is just as important. And so, for people, this could be something that you give a little bit to monthly.
Yeah.
And I think the work is just as important.
Yeah, they can do that online. And the cool thing about that is, like, a lot of people think about those things, but this is something that's right here in our country. I go to Rwanda and I see a lot of churches that are engaged there. And, you know, one of the questions that this Reconciliation Village asks is, they say, how are you being ambassadors for reconciliation at home? Mm-hmm. And I would wonder if a lot of churches, you know, when you think about, I think about, like, you know, there's some organizations, they're building wells and different things, but like, what are we doing in our country? Like, Flint still doesn't have clean water.
Yeah.
You know, there's places in Texas that don't have clean water. So it's, we want to do that too, because we want to be global.
Sure.
And we want to, the uttermost parts, we want to go to those areas and be the hands, you know. But also, it's like you cutting your neighbor's grass without, and neglecting yours. So taking care of your neighbor's family, but neglecting your own family too. Yep. You know, so it's like you want to do both. You want to make sure your neighbor's okay, but also make sure your family is taken care of too. Yep. So we can, it's a both and, it's not an either or. And so I think there's a way, and just, it takes just a little bit, you know, if we did just a little bit, you know, that we can really make some progress, especially as it relates to the youth, you know, in our country, where we could shift some things. I can't change the school system. It's not like I can make them have new textbooks, but we can create supplemental materials so that teachers have access to it, parents have access to it, you know, churches have access to it, to make sure the most important things are being taught to help shift narrative in our kids' minds. So, yeah, that's important.
Totally. Tasha, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,